It's still a struggle. Still got to work on it every single day. But you got to draw the line too. You got to let men know, men and children, everyone, anyone, know that when it's not cool, it's not cool. And to let them know they're out of line and do it in the room right then and there in front of everybody. And then move on.
This is the Sparkcast, a bi-weekly show where we explore the creativity, technology, and business of CG. I'm your host, Marina Antunes.
Collins's artistic journey is a tale of unexpected twists and boundless creativity. As a young artist, Joan found herself deeply rooted in traditional art forms until she saw Supertramp live and found herself mesmerized by the multimedia magic of the concert. This pivotal moment set Joan on a path that would merge her love for art with the allure of visual technology. From crafting concert posters in college to exploring the digital realm in her graduate studies at UCLA, Joan's transition from watercolor and oil to the world of computer graphics is as inspiring as it is transformative. In our conversation, Joan unveils the challenges and triumphs of producing tech shows for SIGGRAPH. What started as modest presentations transformed under her visionary touch into grand spectacles. Joan's ambitions saw her pushing boundaries, which, as she candidly shares, sometimes led to unforeseen hurdles. Tune in to hear how Joan navigated these challenges and glean insights into how traditional and digital art can harmonize to create something truly extraordinary. Here's our conversation with Joan Collins.
Where did you grow up?
Well, few people know that I was born in Seattle, Washington. And then when I was six, my mother moved with her new husband and me and my brother to Opportunity, Washington, which is by Idaho and up there by Canada.
This kind of explains why you went to Washington State University.
Because it was just a little drive, 75 miles away. Go home on the weekends, do your laundry.
What were you like as a kid? Were you pretty artistic? Because you went to school for, your first degree was for fine art, right?
I had a little scholarship for fine art. I liked to paint, but there was no computer graphics back then. And I wanted to be a technical illustrator, whatever that was. Right. But I was a kind of a master watercolorist and oil painter and all kind of that kind of stuff. And big, huge sculptures and just about anything I could do. But oil really smells bad. When you try to paint your oil paintings inside your house, even if it's like basement, it's just like the whole house is definitely oil. So as soon as someone said, you can do all this computer graphics, I'm like, what the hell is that? Tell me everything. I want to know everything.
You like art. You're clearly an artistic person. When you were at Washington State and studying fine art, what was the goal at that point?
At Washington State, it was just to get the degree. That was my goal. Get the degree. But it was a thing for me at that point. I kind of felt like I could have taught my instructors. So if something was due the next day, I'd paint something the night before. I was just not inspired very much. Painting and everything that they were teaching, what I studied, not my academics, but my non-academics, interested me more, promoting and producing concerts. And I also found that if you had concert tickets, you could offer them to your professor and perhaps change the date of the test. But I learned a lot. We were doing professional grade concerts and dealing with professional musicians. I think it was like a 17,000 seat Coliseum and then the outdoor stadium. I was like, well, let's do an outdoor stadium. Well, you have to cover the turf with boards and where do you get that? Well, call Bill Graham down in San Francisco. Okay, hey, Bill, I need something to cover this whole field. Oh, yeah, we'll ship it up. You could talk to anybody. And so there was this free phone for students to do this booking. So we were calling, we were doing a lot, maybe 15 professional grade concerts a year while I was a student. And so basically, that's kind of what I wanted to do when I got out of undergrad. nothing to do with computer graphics yet. It was like painting and then concerts. And then Supertramp came along, Breakfast in America. And they put a projection screen and the train coming at you. And I was like, I'm liking this a little bit more, this visual thing, as opposed to just lights and a palm tree and Beach Boys. I take that back. I love the Beach Boys. So I was kind of going more towards visual, but we're still doing huge concerts the second I got out of school. And I was running a couple places in Seattle. And they're having me still do posters because in order to get the word out, you would do a poster per town because there'd be Music Plus or Ticketmaster. They were all different ways to sell tickets and buy tickets and get tickets. There was nothing online yet still. And to get the posters up, we'd have to have a committee that would cover Idaho and go to bars and physically staple these posters up. So these posters had to look good and they were sweet. They were hand silk screened and luscious. I mean, they're collector's items now. But so for me, fine art was getting spread everywhere. Nobody knew I did them, but they were getting spread everywhere. And I was kind of into that. Comes to the time after this undergraduate experience when I'm more starting my graduate work down at UCLA. But right before that, a nerd who had just attended SIGGRAPH in Seattle, and the nerd who had allowed me to use his cafeteria because I had to spread out all the posters and strip in all the different things. So I had like 20 posters laid out. And he's talking to me while I'm doing all this. He goes, you could do this all on a computer. I'm like, what did you just say? What? What? You mean all this tape and glue and right angles? What? Yeah, you just go down to LA and meet Robert Abel. When you go into Robert Abel's building, and there's several hundred people just dressed to the nines and smelling good, and I mean, they were fast speed. And when I saw the artwork, I was just like, never seen art like this ever. And then when they were showing me the reels, I'm like, oh, forget painting. This is all computer graphics. Oh, and you guys are doing some slit scan stuff. That's John Whitney. What are you doing that for? So at least I knew that because I was at school and I was working with John Whitney Sr. and a whole bunch of people. And they were teaching me everything that computer graphics could do at that point, which was nothing. 1980. Look, it's an Apple Lisa. It draws a circle. Well, this can't be that hard. So I'll do your concerts and you teach me what this thing does. But then I started doing all the big, big shows for SIGGRAPH, which was probably good because they didn't really have a show person until I said, can I just maybe automate this for you? Doing shows for SIGGRAPH and for this local chapter, a local show for us was a regional conference. I didn't know little, I just knew big. And then only 3 years into it, I was called to the principal's office, essentially. There's this thing called ACM, and you really shouldn't have that big of an insurance claim, Joan. And I guess there was this girl over in New York about the same speed. Carol Chiani ran the New York chapter. And she and I got into equal trouble at about the same time. And all of a sudden, ACM was sending an ACM rep to all of our little chapter meetings to make sure Carol and Joan did not get out of control. They were learning at about the same speed as chapters were learning. You have to fill out a technical meeting request form. It was like a mimeographed 3 pages of make sure you order garbage cans. I'm like, have these guys ever done a show before? And it was at that moment that Carol and I decided to stop calling these events and just start calling them meetings. Because for whatever reason, ACM did not require this 3 pages of nonsense filled out. It was just a meeting. So this is how they all started becoming meetings, so that we didn't have to fill out all that stuff. But we were still doing huge, huge shows. It was pretty incredible what they would let you get away with. It was just like, we want to automate the world. Okay, go. How much money do you need? A lot.
How did you get into concert promoting to begin with?
I had a brother that went to school before I did. And while I was in high school, he would dip back into high school land and have me do a poster or two. So that by the time I got to college, I had already been doing posters for these guys. So I was just like on some concert committee immediately out of the gate. Not that I knew if I had a violin player, I would have no idea how to put a microphone in front of them and put a light on them or anything like that. But I learned all that to do something outside of computer graphics. You learn all the other crafts. And I think that is so important to understand analog before you get into digital. And then also be really happy with your analog on the weekends and get rid of all this digital. Because I look at a lot of digital people. I can tell you exactly which frame has a little tiny dot, a speck on it that we have to change. So going to a movie is not fun for me.
Clearly, Supertramp played a pretty big part in your career. Was that the show that had the biggest impact on you? What was your favorite?
I've done over 3,000 shows. Favorite is probably when they allowed me to do something outside the box. Like, for instance, the 87 film and video show for SIGGRAPH. When I said I wanted to automate it, I threw in a couple other things too, like actually automating projectors, actually automating slide projectors, and including film projectors. Step motors were everybody's friends until you introduced them to SMPTE time code, which was all I had at the time. So it's basically, I'll just SMPTE time code stripe this entire 1-inch C composite tape. So it was basically the way to understand what all this was is just to know what you wanted it to be and then start when you get your AV guys in, your audio guys in, and then people start throwing suggestions at you. Like today, Dolby Atmos sound. I'm like, really? 75 speakers are on the top? Wow. Is that a little overkill? Here, listen. No, that is not overkill. That sounds great. A lot of things you don't know to ask for, especially when you're an artist starting off. I'm not a really, you know, I didn't look like the nerd who was supposed to be loading in the audio. I didn't look like the nerd who the audio guys should talk to if they wanted to say, hey, we lost a track. I thought my second day foray into this whole concert thing was to look tougher, but next day I came in, big fur collar, leather coat, cigarette hanging out of my, and that's how I started smoking too, cigarette. And it was the foul mouth started happening. And then I met George Carlin and my foul mouth is off the charts. And I've been having people try to help me become kinder, gentler, back and to be a nice producer, Joan.
You find out about computer graphics, you go down to UCLA. You mentioned you're a woman in a world full of men that don't really know what to expect from you. Can you talk a little bit about that experience in the early 80s when you walk into this place and there's computers everywhere, everything looks really cool, but nobody really knows what they're doing. Everybody's kind of figuring it out. How do you start to sort of like find your way in there? Because you have an advanced degree from UCLA in computer graphics. I mean, that's pretty impressive, especially at that time.
Yeah, but back then, I had to go to just about every college down here to find a thing called a computer graphics class. And if it weren't for friends over at JPL who decided to dump a bunch of computers over on West Coast University, which is neighbors to them, and to kick David M. out of their campus and put him more over into academia land, and all of a sudden, computers in a college place. Wow, this is so cool. How do you make them work? Well, we're going to teach you Fortran. My very first big thing was moving a city across the screen, left, right. That probably took me a semester. Like maybe moving a building across the screen might have been easier. But every single coordinate of anything that needed a coordinate was hand input. Maybe doing my name, which Michael Corey did and got him a job over at Digital Productions. I did not do that. I just always wanted to do whatever I wanted to do as opposed to get, you want to be a lawyer, Joan. What's this computer graphics stuff? As long as it didn't smell like oil paint, I was all over it.
This kind of explains why very early on looking at your bio, there's a lot of overlap between the work that you were doing with productions and school, because you were doing the two things at the same time.
I've always been doing two or three or four things at the same time, running LA SIGGRAPH at the same time too. If I'm not working the whole full time, then it seems like I got a chunk of time. I got to do something with this just to kind of keep coming up with new things, I guess, is the whole thing. Wake up, make something. All I can do is make.
I wanted to ask you about the magic egg, because this seems like a pretty big thing at the time that it came out. The short film for Omnimax that you did an entire sequence for. That was your first full CG sequence, right?
I was working for the nice John Whitney Sr., who was more like a piano teacher. He did not know how to make the computer work. He would sit to the right in a chair, and I'd be like on a stool in front of the computer. And he'd go, no, it's just too stochastic. It shouldn't pop, 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 pop. It should be smooth. Smooth, you say. He would do things like the dots moved around the screen, and then circular pattern, and then inside circular pattern, and then the way they played with each other. And it was all theta and very elaborate splines. However, it was still a series of dots chasing each other. And then it could be a bunch of different colors of dots when the chromatics came in. Yes, it can give you color. You're going to need to write a program to see the color, though. And so that's when beer becomes very important in computer graphics. So in order to get just that little bit of machine code, it wasn't even up to Fortran yet, you need a machine code to call out the color. So we would call out our friends over at Chromatics. We got a case of beer over here. Has your name on it? If you could just come right there. It's, all we need is this one code thing. And so we would sit there and get drunk, because we'd have to stay there all night with him too, to get it all written and test it all. And this didn't happen just one night. This was a lot of different nights, just bringing in real pros, and you had to pay them somehow. We're students, we didn't have bucks like that. We definitely knew everybody. Like the very first SIGGRAPH meetings, let's say there was 25 people there. You know everybody's name in the room. And then as the years go on, you still know those 25, but 100 extra people have been added in. You kind of know almost all their names. They clearly know my name because I'm at a podium. I have no idea who they all are. And now hundreds of thousands of people. But there's definitely a pile of really smart people on this planet. You can get anything done. And I think I'm really excited for where we are right now in the get anything done part. Because you don't have to just make art.
The magic egg is actually on YouTube. And it reminds me of those old light shows at the planetariums.
It is kind of like that, because that's really, really old computer graphics. Well, SIGGRAPH has a huge problem. Back in the day, I mean, all of us did. We were always writing over the top of disks because we didn't know they were important to keep the versions. We just kept going until we liked the version. And we didn't do versioning file names. It was whatever, ABCD up to 20, whatever our versions were. No date, no anything like that. And then as soon as we were done and that went to some TV broadcast, we could still use that same 3/4 inch, kept go to test all of our tests. Who knows what was actually on a lot of these 3/4 inches, unless it was labeled master. When we actually started doing real shots, like when the water weenie showed up in the abyss. But that was in the 90s. The 80s, we were just run amok. If you can find anything from the 80s or before, we need to archive it, because that's not duplicatable anymore. The computers aren't around anymore. We do have most of the computers also archived and working. But that doesn't mean they're going to stay that way forever. Which also brings us to yet another problem, which is, and how are we going to archive these domes? And how do we archive the immersive experiences? And how do we archive the new MSG dome that they're doing at 16K, and dailies are at 4K? And I guess when they started off trying to make dailies, they weren't figuring out at that same time, ooh, we should really think about file naming and protocols and all that. It was just make it work for Mr. Dolan by tomorrow. And then you'd always, on the backside, hopefully somebody took notes on that somewhere, because you're creating as you go, which is how computer graphics started. You'd have some people in there like James Blinn and all these guys who were doing work to test their algorithm, Carl Sims was another one, David M. They would all be creating algorithms, but they needed to render something to see if it worked or not. So this is how SIGGRAPH also started getting all those videos, which was really tests on people's algorithms and did the trajectory work or not.
I think it's worth mentioning you really were at the forefront of getting SIGGRAPH started.
Well, say their first convention-ish, was 74, and I hopped on in 80. But they were still, like, John Whitney Sr. was still doing what could have been, like, analog to computer graphics. But he was doing it a long, long, long time before that. But it was still going out to film. And so there was masters of how to make film look like a certain color. That was a whole different set of problems. But getting it onto film, like at UCLA, it was load a frame, which took forever. Then, in the dark, find your way 8 feet back to where the camera is. Take the two paper clicks and go click. And then the shutter went click. And so if you can imagine us drinking beer, making sure, because it took all night to make one of these things. Like at 3 a.m., your partner, we go, I think it's just to the left a little bit on this frame. No, don't touch the keyboard. Do not. You touch the keyboard. Ah, shit, we're starting over.
The Wild West.
It was just like that. So screw all the lovely file naming. Just try to make it happen, period, is basically where we were.
I want to ask you about the Visual Music Awards in 82, because that also seems like another kind of big milestone in not just your career, but in music videos in general. Can you talk a little bit about what that was and how that came about?
Well, there was a couple of things. There weren't quite awards. I know there was more like festivals. Like if you had it all, if we can scrape together 10 things to make a festival, have people show up, that would be kind of it. But we weren't necessarily giving awards out at first. The one that I did with Francis Ford Coppola and Tony Basil and all that and the two guys that started that. I wasn't there at the very beginning. I just noticed a poster on campus and I thought, poster on campus? Just two guys on that whole committee? Oh, they need more people. So I just called them up. Do you guys need help? Who are you? Yes, we need. And so basically saying you're doing a concert or saying you're doing anything sounds simple until you're 2 weeks before the show. But there was also other people. The Visual Music Alliance had some people in it. And some computer graphics people were coming into it. And they hadn't quite met each other yet. John Whitney Sr. possibly. Also in there were clowns. I use the clown word. However, brilliance was the other part of this person. Like Ed Emshweller. He sent in a piece. And we're all looking at it going, how did he do the water? So beautiful. I mean, he keeps the stones wet. So we go, okay, you're for sure in the show. Okay, I got to tell you that not one part of that was computer graphics. That's just a close-up of some wet stones with a little babbling brook over the top of it. For us, we're looking and analyzing it. And like, for sure, this looks so much more photoreal to have that one layer of specular on it. Wow, he's so advanced. And then we find out, no. We barely had Phong shading. And then when I started selling all the software at Robert Abel's for them, is when all of the other shading and texturing kind of came into play, but it was still barely a bump map, if anything. And these guys were kicking out Super Bowl quality commercials with just the tools we had. Selling the tools was more difficult because it was so expensive. If you were the first person buying it, it's going to cost you $800,000 for the computer and then another $80,000 a year for this lovely license. No, we're not selling it to you, sir, this year. We're going to license it to you because next year's not going to be that software. We will have finished it maybe by next year. And I'm so glad NVIDIA came along so that all those maintenance agreements didn't have to come through us personally, because it was just such a hassle to take all of the calls from people trying to use software, which no one had sold it before yet. And then Wavefront came in after Robert Able started selling their software.
Well, that's really the early days of commercializing software. I think it's amazing that over the course of your career, you've kept your foot both in the digital CG world, but also in the analog projection world, right? Because you were doing a lot of concerts and big events where you were the projection specialist. Can you talk a little bit about how those two things work together to make you better at what you do?
Symbiotic relationship between me and GE, who had the GE light valve projector. I basically just always wanted to have the best that was available in that moment. And I had a beautiful reel, as they said. Robert Able's reel was unmatched in the industry. You couldn't touch it. You just could not come in and touch it. It was just a moment before Pixar. There were still people doing beautiful things. James Blinn was still doing beautiful things, but he wasn't photoreal rendering. So it was just different. It's the closer we got to photorealism and being able to offer it and sell it to the rest of the world, I think was that changing point. I believe officially we have now overtaught visual effects. Now that you all have your own code and you can all do it yourself and it's all clickhead, you don't have to write anything. Everybody can do it, and not everybody can do it well. Everyone can make crap, but not everyone can make a beautiful film that runs for 90 minutes, because that takes 100,000 people to make something like that happen, and a lot of money. You can't make it really look good, and you will not be able to pay top actors. You got to either do it right or just don't call me.
This is something else I wanted to ask you about, because you have quite a list of credits in both commercials, TV, film. When did you get into production and leading teams and managing artists? When did that start as something that you were doing?
By sixth grade, I had everybody in my neighborhood bring their families' picnic tables and benches over to my house. All the picnic tables were a stage. All the benches were the audience in my driveway. I didn't ask permission of all those parents. So we were doing shows back then. And I've always done shows, even though I wasn't supposed to be doing shows. So shows and art are stuck in my brain. That's what comes behind me. Specifically, how they happened is just because I thought they could. And if I can't make that, I'll make this. But there's production, and I guess when I got to Laser Media, right after UCLA, I said that I could definitely animate some of the laser art. And so there I am at my own little digitizing station, essentially animating an oscilloscope is what this whole thing was like. But I just know that while I was at my station, no, you're not supposed to do that. They wanted it 30 frames. No, she said she wanted it by today. You want me to go ask? So I just naturally am a producer, kind of like if you naturally could handle a campground, you can naturally handle 12 kids. So if it's natural for you, then I guess people just make you do it. Unlike just because I can do it doesn't mean I will do it. I have been in some large meetings, and that's what, and you have to draw the line. I know I can. Close the book, put it down. Oh, if there was another female here, perhaps that could happen. But just you have to make them be aware that that's not cool. It's just not cool. So, no, I guess there just won't be notes today if you guys don't know how to take your own notes.
It's easy to forget the fact that in a lot of these places, you would have been the only woman in the room.
For a long time at SIGGRAPH, there'd be like 250 guys sitting all around me and I'd be Joan. And I didn't notice that I was the only female there until people started saying, how does it feel to be the only woman here? But it was more society. It wasn't just me in a room. It was how society was at that time. We couldn't own our own land, couldn't really do a whole lot of stuff. And now it's illegal. You can't actually bully people, whether it's male or female now. You could back then. So we've progressed in a lot of categories. But women put up with that shit all their lives. hundreds and thousands of years. So we're still not quite level right now. Let's still struggle. Still got to work on it every single day. But you got to draw the line too. You got to let men know, men and children, everyone, anyone, know that when it's not cool, it's not cool. And to let them know they're out of line and do it in the room right then and there in front of everybody. And then move on.
I want to make sure that we capture the fact that you were working on shows that played to thousands of people, like 19,000 people. You worked on Olympic shows. You worked on major stadium shows. We're not talking about a concert for 200 or 300 people. These are enormous productions that you were involved with over the course of your career.
And it ends up that the easier shows are the more difficult to do because you have to do everything yourself. The huge shows, there's a lot of people. Now there's enough budget there that you can hire correct amount of people that do the correct little assignments on every show, and it's just perfect. And the person that would be doing everything on a smaller show, like you take a little violin player out, really hard to do, promote and everything else. You do Taylor Swift and hey, I'll be in my dressing room. We used to call the big, big shows the gravy shows because it's just not hard to do. It's harder to come up with new ways to project and make imagery happen than it is to do a Taylor Swift type show.
Let's talk about this new chapter in your life. When did you become obsessed with Nikola Tesla?
I get a lot of scripts, and one came to me, and it was a children's animation. And I, in my normal, subtle self, write back, why the hell would you do a Nikola Tesla show for children? Why wouldn't it be a big show? He goes, well, I do have a script for the big show. Well, why didn't you send me that? And he goes, well, I can. And in this particular case, two gentlemen have been studying Nikola Tesla for the last 40 years. And I just happened to jump into their little gameplay in about, I don't know, 2015 or something like that. And I said, well, I don't know. If you have this script and that script, can you just give me everything you got and I'll go through it and tell you what we should do? And it took me 1 week to download everything they have. I must have read, I don't know, 40 scripts that they had, which included the movie, another movie, another movie, another movie, this section of the movie, that section of the movie, a whole bunch of sections of the movies. That could be a series. You know, it just was going on and on and on. And I said, okay, these are the four we should do out of everything you've given me. When I look at that particular project, I say, we have to do these four that I've decided all at once because we want the same voices on all of them. And I'm not completely convinced that it can be a nobody. I think it can be a nobody if I change his face over, because not everyone knows what Nikola's face looks like. So I think to do him an honor of what all he invented and what he told us would be doomsday 100 years ago, I think it should really be one of those stories that somebody should ought to do and not do it in a stupid way that nobody will watch. It's one of those things that has to be told correctly and financed correctly. I have taken quite a few years getting the finance correct on this particular project.
Can you talk a little bit about VR and immersive experiences? Because that's something that kind of fits also into your wheelhouse of experiences.
Let's break that apart. VR strapped to the head. Madison Square Gardens, all the way around you. It's just a different kind of way to see it. And really, Madison Square Gardens interior is more like an Omnimax film. It's not 360 all the way around. They're just different things and used at different times. Within Tesla, I think there are two sequences, not huge things, but two sequences would be nice in VR just to kind of really, really grasp what he was doing. It was very detail-oriented. All the other stuff needs to be on a big screen. This is not something you should watch. Unless, of course, we got a lot of kids and there's no way you can get them out of the house. A lot of younger people don't know what it looks like to watch Sir Laurence Olivier do one of his shows and see it 60 feet wide on the Sony Cary Grant screen. Once you've seen that, once you've seen the Disney main theater big screen, once you've seen anything just wrap all the way around, you projected correctly. And not that you should know if it's projected correctly or not. When you were growing up, you just know or knew, I don't like watching soap operas because it looks bad. It was some video thing because you've been used to film. But you didn't know why you didn't like it. And so then when you saw something bigger and it was all that more detail given to you, your brain takes it on like a warm blanket. And you could sit there and watch it all day long, except for someone should bring you popcorn. I watched that Madison Square Garden projected in their place of work where they programmed all this stuff, which is different than the screen that they use on the interior right now, which is a bunch of LEDs. So that's really tight pixels. I told the guys afterwards, there is nothing on the planet that has ever been any better than what I have just seen. And that's the programming place as opposed to the big place. But what I like is something that really envelops me. There's people that go to the big screen and they just know it's bright and it's contrasty, but they don't have words for why they don't like it or if they even don't like it. They just know it's really, really bright and maybe they took too much pot and they felt really, really sick, but they're still even better out there. And knowing what I know and looking through the scripts I look at, there's scripts that definitely should be only told immersively. And most scripts have no immersive components whatsoever. But there are scripts that if you peel out this one sequence or you peel out this one whole section, or if you thought this was a series or you thought this was a trilogy, think, it's going to come see a trilogy. Just do one good movie, people. And then in some cases, really, you need an 8-part or a 12-part just to get the story across. Or like Yellowstone or some of the other beautiful TV things now, the episodes don't have to attach to each other and they can all be kind of sort of different, which is also good for these smaller sequences. But generally speaking now, all film projects are wall-to-wall digital. So that's 3,000 shots worth of get it done in a 2-year period.
You talked about how you can't go to the movies really because you don't find yourself enjoying them because you're always nitpicking the things. What do you do to unwind, to take a break, to give your brain a bit of a relax?
Well, I do more shows. I got SIGGRAPH, and LA SIGGRAPH is not a little thing. It's a lot of driving and a lot of really huge players down here, and they want to see their stuff perfect. Also, volunteering is the only job you can have where you don't have to ask your boss if you can try this new thing. It's your thing. You have said it's going to take this much time and this much money, and you have been given that. So now you got to do it. Or you've been given no money, and it's on your own time, and you've invited over 30 of your friends in your backyard. Whatever it is, it still needs to have several items before it can be considered well done. So it's your backyard thing. How did you invite them? Did they get a piece of paper or a beautiful little trinket in their email? What is parking like? Was it air conditioned and heated perfectly so that they couldn't even tell there was a problem? You treat these humans perfectly, and it's part of how they feel they are witnessing the image. But you do not take care of them well. You leave them out in a line with heat or cold or rain. They notice. And they're like, no, this sucks. And they leave. How you treat them from the beginning to how they got back into their car or their bus.
Have you thought about what retirement looks like?
I should be retiring right about now. Frankly, my dad, I think, was forced retirement at 62. I'm starting a studio. We've got like 40 projects in slate ready to start up. This doesn't come with a manual how to do this. You just jump in and start doing it. When people started saying, no, Joan, you go get the money. I'm like, me get the money? I don't go get the money. I produce. okay, well, if you want this done, you got to go get money. So then you have to learn a whole another set of vocabulary. Finance. Oh, I probably should have taken college for this part. I'm not going to go back. I'm just not going to go back to college. It's just all so available right here. And again, you wrap people around you. You need one of these. You need one of these. Oh, you said you could do what? Oh, I'll be needing that. I mean, LinkedIn is so cool. You can meet anybody that does exactly what you're looking for on LinkedIn. I have groups of people that I know exactly what I should have them do if I just need more money. And I think that's the way it's going to be. As soon as we can get more out of this 9-to-5 thinking and a little bit more into, I know, but what should we do? What should we do? What can we do? And it's not just the little stupid stuff that you're just trying to make money on, because that can't be a first reason why you're trying to do something. But people do. Are they happy that they got all that money? I don't know. They got stuff. Do they know where to put all their stuff? I don't know. It's their problem. But I think you should just keep trying to really push the limits. Keep finding people. Talk a lot.
I wanted to ask you about the next step in the creative process, because you've seen over the course of your career, a lot of things come in and out of fashion, in and out of usage. Technology has improved and improved and improved, but it still comes down to the individual making the final decisions and actually looking at the thing and saying, yes, this looks right. No, this doesn't look right. Where does AI fit into this whole discussion? Do you think it fits anywhere in this discussion?
Well, in production is a different animal than research. Research, you got a lot of time to make it work. Production, you don't. So you just find the best of what you've got to go on. But AI in production right now can help the art directors with inference of if they really want to sit there and make 20 or 200 versions of the thing that they're trying to look for. These guys are art directors. They can draw it up in a second of exactly how it's supposed to be framed. You can't start telling the story until someone has greenlit a script, which meant you have your writer's rooms and everyone makes sure the script is tight or don't greenlight it. There's plenty out there. And if they don't want to put the work in, you move on. So it's script, story. And after that, it is the art directors who may or may not choose to get some ideas to help figure out what perhaps a mechanical hummingbird might look like, or a mechanical hummingbird that's also a helicopter. It could just come up with a whole bunch of stuff. And most of it is thrown out. It does not do storyboards well at all. In production, I don't have time for all that. But there are a lot of things that AI can do, and it's not the pretty design stuff, but there is this thing called dailies. And now that we all have to do file naming procedures to a T, it can definitely take a whole section, a whole pile of dailies, chew it up to the slate for us, make sure it has the file names, like that stuff us humans hate to do. And it's in production, and it should be checking that stuff out for us and queuing it all up. And there's mistakes that can be made. Copying file names from one to another. There's just so many clip the end, clip the front, and now it doesn't work. So the AI, I think, there would be good. The creative, not as much, possibly. But I wouldn't be discouraged. It's just like anything else. You cannot throw away all the tools you've developed for the last 40 years, because one of those things will still be usable. So you just keep adding to your tool. You don't throw away anything. I just got through having an analog holiday. It was just a chill out from all this digital.
Do you do that often? Do you take digital breaks?
I try to make sure I turn off all electronics about 7:30. So that my brain cannot think about that one thing that I'm thinking about so much and try to sleep. But I think about it all night long. In the middle of the night, I've come up with some really cool inventions. And if I don't have a paper or anything by my desk, I will get up physically and go type whatever. But they've been pretty good, cool tools. Also, back in the day versus right now, we had to make, like at Laser Media before Robert Able, we had to make all of the data get burned into an EEPROM, an erasable programmable read-only memory chip. And only 8 chips fit on a board. And let's say one chip could almost hold one letterhead piece of paper worth of data. That was it. So if you can imagine doing a 52-minute show, it was hard. And also if anything broke, because there were like these legs that fit into these chipboards and you would pull them out and constantly push them, and then all of a sudden one little leg would break off. We were soldering on legs onto the chips to get them back onto the board mid-show. It was all live. This is why real-time live is so important right now, because I think that's still a baby industry because no one has really elevated it.
I want to ask you about the Tesla Award from the IPA, which you were awarded that in 2021. The first woman to receive that prize in 27 years or something ridiculous. Can you talk about that experience?
It was moving, but at first I felt like, ooh, token female. And then I kind of went through resume. I'm like, oh, I'll pull out things that they might be interested in. So I pulled out like 8 things I had done, which was just a list of things I've done. But then I said, now let me speak to the women of the world. And I pointed to myself, we are in technology and we have always been in technology. And please don't let them put blinders on you. Because here I am, how could it possibly be the only female on the stage for 25 years? I'm sure there's other people that have done things. I'm positive. You can just look around a cigarette, you can tell. They're all over the place. So I'm still the only female sitting on that list of anythings.
And that was our conversation with Joan Collins. You can find out more about Joan and the work that she's doing with the LA SIGGRAPH chapter at lasiggraph.org. The SparkCast is a production of the Spark Computer Graphics Society. Opening and closing credits by Michael Edlund. Editing and additional production support by Marina Antunes. You can find out more about Spark, listen to previous episodes of the podcast, and find out more about upcoming events at sparkcg.org.